So I guess one of the questions really is, what are we doing here? What are we looking into, and why are we looking into? What's the nature of this poem and the various exercises that we do? So I'm going to partly start summarizing what we've been doing this year, but I also want to talk about a slightly new formulation which I've written on the board, really, the idea of the body of flesh, the body of dream, and the body of mystery. Now, that body is really kind of important, corpus. It's the embodiment, the idea of... It contains within it the idea of ground, the idea of presence, of something also that contains. Our bodies are these mysterious, complicated presences, really. And other people's bodies maybe even more so. And I think it's generally true, not just for people with weight issues, as Becky was mentioning, that most people are not very present in their bodies, not very connected to their actual bodies and actual senses. And I think there's lots of different reasons for that. But if we think culturally for a moment, we think of the society in which we're embedded. The body is only prized when it's objectified. So, you know, if the body is considered to be beautiful and sexually desirable, and God knows, if we look at supermodels and look at the models that come with media of what's considered to be desirable, it's an incredibly narrow description of the body. The other place where body is prized is in performance, as in effective athletes. So the body really is a sort of, you know, the narrative of our culture is a device for getting something. Not a place you live in. So, but body gets you admiration, sexual satisfaction, power. Success. In order for the body to be like that, given the very narrow descriptions that could give that, is you have to work your body. You have to be very careful what you put into your body. You have to work out. You have to sculpt your body. And allied to that, then you have to dress your body. We look at the fashion industry, we look at, you know, again, we look at a whole, and we look at how powerful the fashion industry is in our time, partly because media is so powerful. So how people present themselves, clothes are part of body in a way. How we dress ourselves is how we present ourselves, and connected with the image of ourselves that is in itself embedded within the image of the world. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, Penny's comment from Susan Jones about how politicians have to present themselves depending on their body size and shape. You know, Boris Johnson's a great example of this. Right? Big guy, powerful guy, And he is so skillfully presenting himself as the rather slightly buffoonish, but quite bright, quite endearing. You know, he's a very ruthless politician. Look at what Boris actually does. I'll be very surprised if Boris isn't leading the Conservative Party unless something disastrous happens to him. He's positioned well. He's quite ruthless. He's quite clever. Everybody, and he's a, you know, particularly after the next 5 years, David Cameron is probably likely to become less and less popular. You know, you've got Boris there waiting in the wings as the sort of, as the slightly cuddly, slightly a bit daft, but actually not at all showing the kind of intelligent, ruthless politician that he is. Very skillful. If he were presenting himself as who he is, as really showing his steel, this powerful-looking guy would be quite frightening, I think. And so there's something about, in a way, there's something about how, again, the use of the body that is quite different from actually being present in the body. Now, underneath these more recent developments, because we've got the thrust of a society which has elevated the analytical mind to a place of supremacy. So if you can think and argue, particularly if you can argue in a kind of pugnacious way and beat other people in argument, then you get a lot of rewards from that. You know, if we consider that most of our political leaders come out of either Oxford or Cambridge, many of them, you'll discover, have belonged to the debating societies that are very powerful in those places. So they learn how to crush argument. They learn how to hone the mind. They're there in Oxford and Cambridge anyway, because normally most of them have gone to public schools where the kind of qualities that Oxford and Cambridge look for are honed from quite an early age. So what that does in some ways is it creates a sort of, if you like, a field of value, where the things that are valued is the ability to dominate, to win. It's a very competitive ethos. You're more beautiful. You dress more in a smarter way. You're in touch with the trends. You're particularly these days with Twitter and things. You know what we've got this new word, trending. You've got to be in touch with whatever is trending and working with that. And in a way, what that does is create, it does two things. It creates a really it takes us away from a place of center and creates quite an instrumental approach to life. So Benny's story, the people who are self-publicists, who are working with that image, never get forgotten. Doesn't matter what they do, they never get forgotten, because they're working that zeitgeist there. But what's interesting for me, when you come across people like this who are they become very dependent on the zeitgeist. Facebook's interesting for them. I love Facebook. I think it's a fascinating medium. I find it so interesting, and not just because I get to look at cute dormice and things, which I did last night, which is good. But I think it's genuinely a sort of interesting thing. If we want to look at what's going on in the collective, Facebook's brilliant for it, because and people do all kinds of different things with it. And the people who, and there's certain people who have, you know, they have enormous number of followers and friends. And what's noticeable in the people that do it like that is that, and some people are just doing it as a business thing, that's kind of okay, and that's just different. But there's other people you see that there's a sort of a need for constant approval, constant praise. They need to be called how wonderful, and lots of people have to tell them. And it's a sort of bizarre phenomenon in some ways, because most of these people, they have never met and never will meet in their lives. They're just, you know, they're virtual presences. And there's something about the absence of center in that, and in a way, there's an absence of embodiment. Because the direction of your consciousness is over there. It's out as what's coming towards me, who likes me today, or it's what am I achieving next week, or am I getting it, you know. So there's an absence of here, now, presence. You know, one of the reasons for the sort of success of the sort of mindfulness movement in mental health circles, which is actually starting to wear off a bit now, I realize, judging by recent studies, is because it introduced this radical idea that you can pay attention to your body, and if you start to do that, you start to feel better. Interestingly, what happened to me, you know, mindfulness is this very powerful kind of practice of noticing, just noticing where you are. In a way, not being instrumental with your body, listening to your body. What happens if I just listen to my body? Well, what starts to happen is you start to slow down a bit. Mind's much faster than the body. Mind's much more mobile. Body is in present time. You start to come into both the special senses, which are the things we normally think of as senses, which are the, you know, hearing, sight, smell, taste. But we also start to touch the somatic senses, which are based, so the sense of touch is one of the somatic senses, so that's a global sense. There's also proprioception, the sense of positioning in space. There's the sense of pain or the sense of hot and cold. So these are the kind of global kind of senses. Balance is another one. Now, one of the interesting things that neurology has been discovering is that our sense of ourselves arises from the body. It arises from a whole set ways of, and in particular, the somatic senses, which are the particular senses which we don't really notice because they don't appear useful.
Can you define that word, please? I don't know.
The somatic senses. Somatic. The word somatic means of the body. Soma.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So, and the somatic senses. So the specialized senses that we think of are the senses that we use. Right. That reach out. So hearing, sight, smell, taste. Yeah. The somatic senses are connected very much with the sense of touch. Well, the touch is often seen as one of the special senses as well, but the somatic, there are ways of our nervous system receiving our experience. So and it's very much connected with the biology of the brain. So the proprioceptive sense is about our positioning in space. It's how I know that where I am and where you are. Sense of pain obviously is a special adaptation of the sense of touch. So you know when you're in contact with something that is harming with your body. You're also able to sense whether things are hot or cold. Sense of balance gives you know if you lose your sense of balance, you start falling over. You know, and one of the things that neurologists have discovered is that there's a complex mapping system that happens in our nervous system around our relationship with ourselves and around our relationship with the world around us. You know, when you're driving, when I'm driving in touch with my car, my sense of myself is in my body, but also is somewhere my body extends to the edges of my car. When I'm trying to sense, can I go through a gap? I'm feeling my car, my sense of my car. Mostly I get it right, very occasionally I get it wrong. But so our sense A proprioceptive sense isn't just the literal kind of sense of a body, it also includes the space around us. If you're poking something with a stick, and you really notice your body, notice your sense of yourself, your sense of yourself will include the stick, and include whatever you touch with the stick. Now, as we let ourselves include that, and include that sense of space around us, as well as space within us, we're playing with these two principles that here I've called the body of flesh and the body of dream. Body of flesh, in a way, is our literal body, our sense of ourself, our sense of what happens, our felt sense of what happens inside us. But there's also this other aspect of self or body, which is more fluid. That has the capacity to include more than just the physical limits of our bodies. So it's the place where we feel into a room, or we feel towards another person. I won't get into all the neurology of it, but there's a lot of interesting stuff around neurology and neuroplasticity, which is also our capacity to learn and our capacity to make new connections. Well, one of the things that happens when we are disconnected from our body. Not only are we disconnected from our actual body, and we can do it, and you know, we can just knock into things and fall over, and we get very ill sometimes and not notice it. But we also disconnect from the imaginal body, or the body of dream. So our capacity to from ourselves feel into the world around us, meet the world kind of consciously, and notice what's coming at us diminishes. Now, one of the things that that capacity, which is part of the capacity of the imagination, is incredibly practical and straightforward, but it's also part of the qualities that people who are really very good at things really need. If you look at a really great tennis player, one of the interesting sort of studies around tennis has been that actually the capacity to anticipate, to sense into what's coming at them, is a higher order skill that it depends on more than your actual immediate sense of the ball coming towards you. It's a capacity to envision. It's a capacity of vision, to sense the possibilities and to respond to that, so that you're responding to the emergence of something before it emerges. Now, this is a capacity that we all have, but it's a capacity that gets interrupted because of history, because of a culture that doesn't want us to be active in that way, that wants us to more passively consume. And in particular, the particular problem that we have around both the sense of being in our body and being in connection with the body of dream as well, is that our sense of I know how things are, the density of our story, which takes us away from being present with the possibility of emergence and of something different happening. Because what happens is, as we come into these places, as we come into our body, as we come into our sense of possibility, we meet our history, our belief, and our memory about me in my life. So, for example, if I've learned that I have to carry all the load and there's no way out, and I'm uh, and And that's really been my experience. You know, that's not just a sort of, you know, unfortunate belief I hold. That's really, you know, it's what's happened to me. So when I'm in the place where something needs to change, and I need to therefore to be present in my in the body of flesh, open to the body of dream, open to some other possibility. One of the major things that likely will get in the way of that is the belief, not just the belief, but the experience that there is no way out for me. No safe way out, perhaps. Now what, because what that does is to organize your perceptions, organize your experience around the experience of the past. And so what happens, instead of staying open to the possibility of something, not that that's easy, because to stay in the particular example I'm thinking of, to be present with that is to be present with opposites that feel, I want to get out, there's no way out. Get out, there's no way out. Maybe I plan, I think of ways out, I get exhausted, and so I'm back in, I want to get out, there's no way out. And so maybe what my patterns say in that, well, okay, I've got to put up with it. Got to live with it, got to be realistic. Mustn't be silly. Now as I do that, my perceptions, my sense of connection to possibility diminishes. I also start to disconnect both from my body and from the world around me. Because what happens is I start to become, I live in the image of myself and the image of the world as I know it. And you know, if you're like me, 60, the things you know have a density. They have momentum. So of course they feel very solid. And I've learned, of course I've learned to live with it. Whatever it is.
Excuse me.
But the problem is, what is cut out from that equation then is the possibility of the mysterious, of difference, of the unknown. If we had been brought up in a society that says, actually, as a young person, one of the things you need to do is to spend time, if you're going to be a full participant in our society, is spend time finding your spirit self and communicating with your spirit self and find your power spot upon the earth that will nourish you, that will connect you. And at significant parts of your life, you must return to your power spot, you must commune with your spirit self, and you must listen to what the power spot says and what the spirit self says. And if as part of your annual review, your manager says to you, okay, what does your spirit self say today? How many days have you spent sitting at your power spot? And what are your dreams and visions? Now that would be a very different world, wouldn't it? Okay, that would be, you know, because all of this is consigned to places like Glastonbury or, you know, ayahuasca ceremonies or whatever, but actually it speaks in a way how the body of dream is split away. Now when we look at the poems of Taliesin or the stories of the Mabinogion, You know, they're complex things, and why do we study them at all? Well, partly we study them because the people who wrote these things knew about the body of dream, took it seriously. We're able really to listen to that side of themselves. Not in a disconnected way, but in a way that was incredibly grounded. And it's not just the Celts who did that. You know, you find, you know, the kind of oracle systems you had in the ancient world. You know, the issues that people used to go to oracles with were very practical issues. Should we go to war? If we go back to pre-Socratic Greece, the Parmenides, who's one of the great visionaries of Greece, was a magistrate. One of the things that he used to do if he was trying cases, he would go into a cave and he would consult the gods. And it's literally the equivalent of a high court judge saying, "All right, I must now, okay, thank you, I've now heard this case, I will now go into my meditation chamber. And we'll see what the gods have to say, or the goddesses have to say to us about this." Yeah, it's beyond imagination, isn't it? If you think about the law. But that's, when we talk about the ancient Greeks like this, we're not talking about, these are the people who created logic. These are not sort of stupid people. Greek cities are very cosmopolitan. You know, there's a lot of cynicism, there's a lot of rational argument, but there is the inclusion of something that we have lost. And they're forever trying to get back, you know, are perpetually organizing it. So the mindfulness thing was really interesting, okay? So this is something very interesting. Suddenly I thought, wow, this is going to be amazing, this is going to really change the nature of mental health. And no, of course it's not, because what happens is it becomes part of the dominant narrative. So it becomes an aspect of cognitive process. So rather than really paying attention to the body and really going into the depths of the body, going into what the Celts would have called anun, the deep place, the place that is not a place, it becomes, well, this is a good way to change your thinking about being depressed and make you more motivated. Now, you know, that's inevitable given the culture we live in, but also the problem is that energy is in us. We touch something and immediately, out of fear of the unknown, fear out of the body of mystery, which is what happens when in a sense, when the body of flesh and the body of dream collaborate together. So the vision or the dream imagination connects with ground, with somatic senses. What starts to emerge is the third body, the body of mystery, where there is the potential for the unknown to become manifest, for something new to emerge. And that's very frightening. Because we have no training in that. Our training is in the opposite direction, right? Our training is really about, is all about not being with the body at all of any kind, and certainly not being with the imagination, and learning how to fit in, learning how to be useful. But of course these qualities are needed. Vision and imagination is needed in human society. So these qualities are still there and are still called upon. But they're called upon in an attenuated form. So the great visionary enterprise of our times is advertising. You know, as people, when we talk about, you know, esoteric groups or meditator groups or therapy groups, they pale into insignificance between the visionary power of advertising. You know, it's the great driver of our society, because it's designed, you know, because consumption is the big, you know, the capitalist society, consumption and keeping the money flowing, you know, is the key driver. And so advertising is the mechanism that enables that to happen, by convincing ourselves that we need whatever it is they're selling. And it affects all kinds of things. We have the technology to make cars that would never break down, for example. Take a topical issue. But we're never going to do that, because actually we need cars to break down. We need there to be constant novelty, so that the money keeps flowing. There has to be a better, brighter car every time. It's not wrong, but it does just mean that the mechanism advertising uses is the idea that we are not complete in ourselves. We need to buy whatever the next thing is. We need to buy it in order to be complete. And if you notice, if I notice what happens to me when I'm doing that, some of these books, so for a moment, the moment when I buy the book, before I have received the book, I feel full. When I've got the book, it's just part of me again. It's no longer the tantalizing object. It no longer holds the possibility of the dream. And it's because its mysterious aspect becomes just part of me again. It's lost its mysterious edge. And this is always the problem of the process of consumption, because we're reaching out for the body of mystery through, if you like, an adaptation of the body of dream. Through advertising convinces us we need something. It conveys something of the numinosity of the body of mystery. Until we get it, and then it's just part of us. It's assimilated.
It's the advertising slogan: "Don't sell the sizzle, not the steak."
Yeah. That's right.
Sell the aspiration.
Yes, sell the aspiration. That's right. Once you've got it, you've got it. It's the next sizzling. That's absolutely it. But all these things depend upon these very powerful capacities we have that we have been persuaded out of. I always think of Carlos Castaneda when I think about this. People know about Carlos Castaneda. Books started to appear in the 70s, quite early on. Mainstream publisher, Penguin, I think it was Penguin even, something like that. Appeared in very ordinary bookshops, telling this amazing story. Telling a story about this American guy, Carlos Castaneda, from Guatemala, but living in California, who encounters this Yaqui Indian called Don Juan. And Carlos was a very good writer. So it takes you into this quite magical world. You know, the world of the Sonora deserts, where he encounters, the first book is all about drugs, it's part of the zeitgeist of that time, but very quickly he goes beyond drugs into the working with the perceptions of the body. And what he shows you in his books is the dialogue between his concrete mind and this more mysterious aspect of himself. Now, the bizarre thing about the old Carlos Castaneda books is they almost certainly were made up. There's very powerful teachings and ideas inside them, but they're very. But as from what we can't definitively know, but it's very unlikely there was an actual Don Juan. It's all Carlos Castaneda's creative interpretation of a process. But he presents it. But he is so, in a way, what was genuinely interesting about his work is that it worked. If you took his ideas and played around with them, you found that, this is my experience and lots of other people I've talked to, you found that actually they had a meaning and they had value and they altered your perceptions of life. Now, he was so successful at doing this that he acquired a doctorate from Berkeley, because of his anthropological research and this with Don Juan, who almost certainly didn't exist. So one level, he's a liar, he's a trickster, he's but the thing There was somebody else called Lynn Andrews who tried to cash in on this and started to do a woman's version, because he was a bit misogynistic, or Carlos Castaneda. Now, her works were nothing like as influential somewhere. And partly they were not as influential is because he was tapping something in his own experience, I imagine, that really spoke. And she was quite not. He had made this connection between the body of dream and body of flesh. And so when you read his things, they affected you somatically. And one of his ideas was he says, well, if these two things, and again he took the Central American terms. One is there is this part of us he called a Nagual. Nagual means jaguar, but he didn't say it. It means Nagual is your spirit self. Is the self that is always mysterious, that cannot be known. And everything else, he says, is the tonal. Everything that you know is part of the known experience. He says, like, everything that we know is like the tabletop, but the Nagual is what's underneath. Perpetually mysterious, and perpetually things keep away, and the work in some ways, and in his series of books, what he's talking about, the Donoano represents this Nagual, and he does all kinds of crazy things that keep Carlos, little Carlos, is the tonel, the rational kind of self, is always making sense of things, has to make sense of things, right? So not saying that the tonel is wrong, or that the rational self is wrong, or the body of flesh is wrong, but it has to be in constant relationship with the body of mystery that is mediated through the experience of vision and dream and mysterious things happening. Now, for me, these things is to get, studying psychology and at the university. And in some courses, Carlos Castaneda's books will get recommended. They wouldn't these days, but, it was a different world. Because one of the things that was that psychologists were interested in, and I was very interested, still am interested in, is the idea of that the different hemispheres of our brains process things differently. The cerebral cortex. So one side of our brain, the left side of our brain, left side of the cerebral cortex, in a sense, monitors or manages the left, the opposite side of the body. But one of the things that the brain research really looked at is how that the right side of the brain, they would say, which in most of us operates the left side of the body, unless we're left-handed, which is slightly different, is really responsible for the intuitive, non-rational dreaming capacity, I suppose you could say. Other side of the brain is responsible for the rational, the making sense, the grounding, the creating of the coherent story. A lot of this early research that they did around this came up because there was a process. They used to cut the corpus callosum, which is a sheath of fibers that connects the right and left side of the hemisphere. They used to do that in relation to epilepsy, because it used to be one of the places where epilepsy would spread. And they had some very, very weird things started to happen to people who had that operation. They'd find different sides of their body operating independently. A classic cases of husband finding his left hand wanting to strangle his wife. Well, and in a way, it's almost like aspects of, you might say, of the Freudian unconscious becoming kind of visible. One of the things that this cutting, a rather dramatic and not very good operation, made visible, was that if these two sides of ourselves come out of relationship, it is literally like you have two people going on at once. They have different personalities, different aspects of different ways of viewing the world, different ways of operating in the world. Now, generally speaking, that they are integrated because there is a connection between them, and certainly a lot of the neural mapping understanding of the brain really shows us that the brain does operate as a whole. So these different capacities become integrated together. around a central narrative, around a way of because it's the, because literally, so the really fascinating stuff about neural research is that the connections in our brains are created, are constantly being recreated. It's this idea they call neuroplasticity. I used to one time to believe that you know, once you grow up, your nervous system is hardwired. What they've really discovered is our nervous system keeps adapting, keeps creating new connections throughout our lives. I was talking to Ali about something this morning about one of the things they discovered about amputees is it's really important, if you're going to get somebody to use an artificial limb, you have to strap the limb on very early on so that before the mapping system of the body reorganizes itself to be without a limb. Because you're reliant on the sense that you've still got a limb there to help you sense that is part of your body. You also get things like disorganized body maps. So there's a whole little subgenre of people who want to have bits of themselves amputated, because there are bits of their body that don't feel like they're part of the body, and I think that's because their neural maps sort of haven't properly formed, and so their bodies feel like the end actually there. That's the actual somatic experience. So this feels like some weird kind of bit. That's tacked on. So what all of this is sort of is saying to us in some ways is that there are these different capacities within us that are constantly learning, constantly developing, but become obstructed and disorganized or locked in particular ways due to whatever experiences we've had and then. Constantly reinforced. Now we all carry around with us sets of beliefs and story that we are constantly recreating. And so what happens, our connection to what Donovan might have called the Nagual, the body of mystery, becomes occluded, because instead of the body of dream, which is this capacity to sense, the capacity to open, the capacity to imagine, being a kind of open and connected to our sense of immediate presence, it becomes connected and organized around history. The sense of this is who I am, and this is the world that I live in. I know that this is true. You know, it's the Buddha's image of the self. Buddha's great image of the self, where he says the self is like a ring of fire created by a burning torch swung very, very fast in the middle of the night. Now, actually, it is the momentum that creates the shape of the self. This is pretty much exactly what the neurologists would say, that actually out of all these processes, we acquire a sense of self that integrates and holds all this together, but also continually is interacting with us with the neural mapping processes so that the system remains coherent. In order to change, you have to find a way of tolerating a certain degree of incoherence. In a way, you have, in a certain sense, I suppose, you have to become present in the body of flesh. That's always the starting point. Present here and now, open to the kind of mysterious aspect of your being through the capacity to sense and feel through the imagination. As you do that, what happens is these different parts of yourself start to relate together. The imagination becomes substantial. The sense of the physical body becomes more fluid. And you start to touch this edge of the unknown, the body of mystery. Now, there's a 16th century description of somebody going relating to the idea that the Celts called Awen, that thing that we talk of, where he goes off up on the mountain. He sees somebody seeking new vision in their life. Right, so stuck, doesn't know what to do, and goes stomping up a mountain. So in a sense, engaging with the body, engaging with the earth, getting kind of quite physical. And then goes to sit down in a place that feels that they just, you know, not a particularly known place, so just a place where they feel drawn to. They go to sit down. You could say that you'd be finding their power spot, their place of connection to things. So that there's a sense of, if you like, they're established through walking around, stomping around. They get away from, if you like, the complete dilemma that keeps reconstellating. That place where you just think, oh God, I'll just walk, you know, or I'll go and sit somewhere. I'll kind of use my body as a way of sort of stopping my mind driving me mad. But as I open to that, I start to sense the world around me. I start to sense the mysterious aspect of the world. I'm drawn to something. I sit down. And then what starts to happen is I start to become available to the body of dream. So what happens in this particular story is the person has a vision of a magical man with a hawk on his wrist, and who's got a crown of leaves on him, and who is this kind of, you know, for the culture, for the 16th century culture, this would be a fairy being. Right, so they encounter a fairy being, and at a time when people believed in fairies, and the fairies were not cutesy things, but were actually quite powerful, rather frightening figures. And the fairy and the man have a conversation, and the fairy says, "Well, I can help you, but you have to look after my hawk for me. I will help you as long as you look after my hawk." And so the guy has to think about that and decide. And again, he has to treat it seriously, because it's a big deal to do a deal with fairies. They're very vindictive and vicious if you let them down. So he decides, okay, yeah, all right, I'll. And then what happens is the hawk takes off and flies into his mouth and then comes to live in his entrails. And then he says, "And forever afterwards, I've had to look after and feed the hawk that lives in my belly and listen to it. And sometimes it takes me to the man, sometimes it brings the man to me." And the hawk is the Awen. It's this kind of mysterious, powerful, but substantial energy. Right? It's the living mystery right in the heart of your own physicality that you have to keep feeding, have to keep relating to. And in a way, you know, the 17th century person is lucky at that point, because that these are beliefs that are still around. So somebody will have said to him, "Well, go up the mountain and go and talk to the fairies." Now, plenty of people in Glastonbury talk to fairies. That isn't really what I mean. The thing that was sort of interesting about Carlos Castaneda's words is nobody knew what the hell they meant, for one thing. Tonal Nagua, they didn't have any antecedents. In order to do this, we have to... Because our problem is, if we have an image of, if I need to go and talk to the fairies... Problem with that idea, if it's a known idea to us, it's also part of the known self. Because what you sort of have to do is come away from the known, and you do that by going into the body and by being in the heart of the impossible dilemma. And as we embrace the dilemma, whatever it is, whatever the edge is, we become here and now present to our body and present to the world around us. It's not a cut off, disconnected place, right? So as we allow ourselves to relate to that, we start to relate to ourselves and our world, and that also means our fears, it also means all the stories that tell us we shouldn't do that. And we start to, the body of flesh starts to embrace the body of the dream. And the world starts to get a bit shaky. And our sense of ourselves starts to get a bit shaky. And that's where we're on the edge of touching the body of mystery. Now Jung tried to help us with this when he talked about the idea of synchronicity. But the problem with synchronicity, it's become a known word and it's lost its power. The synchronicity is weird things happening that crack the world open. Many years ago, Nellie and I had a flat in Cardiff. Before we'd moved in, really, we had I don't really remember the detail, but what I remember that's powerful about it is that we'd left the flat, it was totally empty, and we were very excited. It was a very exciting flat, first time we'd lived together, and it was really about newness and new beginnings, new life. Okay, it was all that early kind of exciting stage of your life. We walked in there one day, nobody had been in there, and there was green corn spread across the floor. Do you remember?
Oh yes.
It's possible that the landlord, very unlikely, I have to say, the only person who had access to the credit key to that was the landlord.
Druggy landlord.
The chances he walked in is sort of most awful seedy block. I asked him about it, but he said he didn't know what I was talking about. Very Cardiff, yeah. Telling all kinds of stories about that flat and the owner, but anyway, we'll go there. But the thing that is powerful about it, that remains powerful about it, is established really. There's no way that green corn could have appeared. No human agency did that. I believe that. And so, if I have to deal with the reality of the green, if I have to deal with the reality of the green corn, you know, there's a few sheaves lying on this empty room at a time when we're about to begin something. So it's such an appropriate image. What it does is to stop my world. And it's in that moment of stopping that we touch something else. Now, versions of this happen all the time, but mostly we don't notice them. So there's something about the web of mysterious connections that are both in our nervous system and in the world. And be letting ourselves be available to that. That is both wonderful and terrifying. And extraordinary and sort of ordinary. You know, it's a bit like you go to, you know, you're doing an app about weight loss, and the buck fits the buck fizz man. How does that happen? I don't know. It's mysterious, actually, if you think about it. You can go out looking for him. You're going out looking for him in a different thing. But something mysterious happens. And if we can sort of learn to try and trust ourselves and our lives, which is very difficult to do, I think, because of old hurts and fears, then sort of everything becomes an aspect of this interplay between the body of flesh, body of dream, and the body of mystery. So if we're stuck in somewhere, or if something difficult has happened to us, or something unexpected has happened to us, of course we have to feel it, it impacts our story, we're upset by it, we need to do all these things, these are normal things, in a way these are all part of assimilating something in, but if we can assimilate it in present experience, even the story, not making the story wrong, right, the story is also part of the body of flesh, but if we're present with it, knowing it as the story replaying itself, there's something else starts to happen. As we start to connect with the body of the dream, we start to create the matrix, the possibility of the rising of the body of mystery.
Just asking,
yeah.
Where does vision fit into this? Because I find quite a lot I'll be playing a scenario in my mind that hasn't happened.
Yep.
Wondering what I'm going to do if it does happen.
Yep.
And then it happens.
Yep.
But it's different. It's like there's always a slight difference to it, but
yeah,
it's not so different that it's not the vision, if that makes sense.
No, definitely, yeah.
And I find myself thinking, why am I worried about this? Because it hasn't... But it's not... No, it's interesting. It's not a worry. It's like the last one I had, I was trying to work out that if I had to deal with someone who had bodyguards, I mean, this sounds stupid, right?
Yeah.
Well, I had to deal with someone with bodyguards, where would I sit them while I was seeing the person? Why that bothered me, I don't know. And then,
yep,
within 3 days, I was escorted from a talk in order to see someone, and suddenly there were these two people escorting me, and I looked at them and I remember thinking, where are they going to sit? They weren't bodyguards, it was an escortion too.
Yeah.
And then they had to find somewhere to be for that time while, yeah, I was seeing this person. So, but I notice I concern myself beforehand when it isn't even a reality.
Yes, but that's because you're picking, in a way, this thing I'm calling the body of dream is that implicate place where you're touching possibility. Right? So you're touching, so it's not literal, so it isn't, it,
no.
but you're touching a field of possibility. So you don't know that you are, you're just thinking about it, right? So you're just, but you're letting yourself think about it. And in a way, this is a bit like the tennis player anticipating the ball, in a slightly larger example of that. Because you're sensing something moving towards you. You don't know you're sensing it.
Mm.
But that's often, I think, what happens. This sense of, and we don't always get it right, because there's an interaction that happens between, if you like, the known stories. Because this is the sort of mediating principle. If you like, if the body of mystery is the mysterious, the deep place, the body of dream, if you like, is our personal connection, our connection to sort of, to what's arising out of the mystery. It's that more fluidic, it's the same part of ourselves that sits in the car and feels the car around us. Okay, it's a reaching out, it's a process of reaching out and sensing. So in that moment, in what's happening to you, part of you is reaching out to this event that hasn't quite happened yet.
Mm.
And is of course trying to make sense of it in terms of what actually is happening here and now. So you think of your practice and you think of this, because you don't know that's going to happen to you after a talk. But somewhere you've prepared. You see, what's interesting about that is there's been a rehearsal process that has prepared you for that situation. So it's interesting,
yeah,
isn't it, you say?
I see that now.
Yeah.
You used the word implicate, so
I
the implicate and the explicate and David Bohm.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Well, he talks about this as well, yeah.
Yes, so it seems like, in a way, quantum physics
has
put this in a scientific way that is still even too kooky for some people, even though it's actually... describing the interconnections, and our vision of the world is about separate objects with no connection.
That's right.
And his thing is actually, because we're just seeing the top, we're just
seeing
the
that's right.
text implicate rather than...
The implicate, that's right. Because in the implicate, there's this idea called quantum entanglement, where particles not in touch with each other, sometimes separated by enormous distances, something happens to one particle, there's a reflex in the other particle. So quantum physics is seriously bizarre. I mean, in a way, if you start to look into it properly, you actually see some of the things that we experience at a much more macro level as actually, in a way, as the foundations of the universe, of this mysterious, interconnected, fluid place, where that place of mystery is sort of happening all the time. And the capacity, the capacity to tolerate this is one of the key things, right? Because actually the problem with opening out into the field of mystery, we need to finish because we're going to go to lunch, but I'll come back to it after lunch. But let's end on this point, that the capacity to tolerate this is what enables us to develop these capacities and help them to work together. And what we mainly have to do to help ourselves do that is get present and work with the fear that inspires our stories, so that we can tolerate the possibility of difference and newness. Let's stop there for a moment, because we need to go for lunch, but we'll...